I think about, you know, how online safety and the vitriol that so many Black folks experience, that it's almost become a norm that they don't see it as a safe space. We don't talk about the folks that are leaving because of the systemic racism and violence that they experience.
What about the experiences of Black women and gender diverse people in digital spaces? I'm Andrea Gunrach from the Canadian Women's Foundation. Welcome to All Right, Now What, a podcast from the Canadian Women's Foundation. We put an intersectional feminist lens on stories that make you wonder, why is this still happening? We explore systemic roots and strategies for change that will move us closer to the goal of gender justice. The work of the Canadian Women's Foundation and our partners takes place on traditional First Nations, Métis, and Inuit territories. We are grateful for the opportunity to meet and work on this land. However, we recognize that land acknowledgements are not enough. We need to pursue truth, reconciliation, decolonization, and allyship in an ongoing effort to make right with all our relations. Whether you're on social media, streaming platforms, dating, messaging, or meeting apps, or on game sites, if you're a woman, girl, or two-spirit trans or non-binary person, you're at greater risk of hate, harassment, and violence. Misogynoir, a term coined by Dr. Moya Bailey, describes a distinctive form of anti-Black sexism faced by Black women. We've explored it in previous episodes. How does it show up in digital spaces? The data available paints a distressing picture. UK and US data shows that racialized women are 34% more likely to be mentioned in abusive or problematic tweets than white women, and Black women are especially targeted. They are 84% more likely than white women to be mentioned in these tweets. In Canada, 44% of women and gender-diverse people aged 16 to 30 have been personally targeted by hate speech online. Those most likely to be targeted include Black women and gender-diverse people. Over coming episodes, we're delving into gender digital hate and harassment with leading experts and content creators, releasing in-depth episodes every single week. We talk about the problem and what we can do to change it. We offer practical tips to help you in your digital life, and we talk about what it means to take back the tech for all of us. Our guest Yami Kanyi-Misosa helps us understand these experiences so often under-recognized in research. Yami Kanyi is a Black neurodivergent non-binary award-winning activist and cultural worker on the stolen traditional and ancestral homelands of the Anishinaabe Algonquin Nation people. They are executive director at the Ottawa Coalition to End Violence Against Women. They co-chair the Advisory for Advancing Gender Equity for Black Women, Girls, and Gender Diverse Peoples in Canada initiative, and also founded Seeds Yoga for Survivors. A note about content. This episode addresses gender-based violence.
So my name is Yami. I use they, them pronouns, and today I'm calling in from unceded, unsurrendered Algonquin Anishinaabe territory. I am a visitor on these lands by way of forced migration. So my people are the Ngoni and Zulu people of southern Africa. They are people of the water, and in many ways, I carry a lot of that in my lineage and in how I move through the day, reflecting that of fluidity and openness and life-giving, but also, you know, engaging in some good trouble and some destruction of patriarchal, racist, white supremacist structures. In my day-to-day job, I am the newly appointed executive director of the Ottawa Coalition to End Violence Against Women. The gender-based violence movement has been part of my feminist politicization for the last 15 years, and I'm grateful to be of service to the movement in good ways. In terms of what's bringing my heart joy, definitely plants and trees in the water. I've been super intentional of just spending time with the land and expressing gratitude, because right now the land and Mother Earth is communicating quite loudly with us in terms of shifting what's needed in terms of the climate crisis. And yeah, it's been really bringing me joy to like hug trees, just be out in nature and find that grounding and listening to what Mother Earth has to say to me. So I know that sounds so like she frou-frou, but you know, it is what it is. I am who I am. So
what have you found in your research about Black women and gender diverse people in digital spaces?
You know, I don't necessarily see myself as a researcher. It's not kind of the ministry or the paradigm that I operate from. I think much of what I've been engaged with is an exercise of deep listening and noticing within community and being part of a movement that historically has erased and forgotten intentionally through systemic violence, through epistemic violence, which I'll talk about in a bit, from the experiences of Black women, girls, and non-binary folks. There's been an acute interest around the discourse of online hate and its connections to misogynoir, as well as trans misogynoir, which are transparently, you know, here on Turtle Island, you know, here in Canada, they're not conversations. And, you know, there's very little research actually on the experiences of Black folks online, but yet we see the way that Black folks impact culture, digital culture online profoundly, memes to the language that's used, you know, in terms of AAVE or African American vernacular and how that gets like co-opted online. But the violence that's experienced by Black women, Black femmes, and non-binary people is not part of the larger discourse and conversation around digital hate and online hate. And so given my positionality, it's been something that I've been really passionate about talking about and really highlighting the gaps that exist systemically, you know, within our feminist gender-based violence movement.
What are the underappreciated stories and experiences of Black women and gender diverse people in digital spaces?
You know, when I think about the circulation of like when there is an experience of police brutality against Black women or Black femmes or non-binary folks, and those stories are circulated without critical pause of the level of violence, that the secondary violence that's experienced in those images being seen as like a news story, and the impact that it has on community. And I think that that's something that has been articulated, has been noted, but you know, the mental health impact of that is dire. And I think that's why it's so critical for us to consider online misogynoir as a public health issue. I think about, you know, how online safety and the vitriol that so many Black folks experience, that it's almost become a norm that they don't see it as a safe space, you know, and there's been tons of folks that do amazing resistance work in the gender-based violence movement that have completely removed themselves off the platform. And we don't talk about that. We don't talk about the folks that are leaving because of the systemic racism and violence that they experience, but how it's also a space of connection, and how that gets taken away from folks. I think about the ways in which young Black girls are being impacted by the images that they're seeing online, what's being reflected to them. There's this study that was done in the UK, and it looked at the US and the UK and looked at misogynoir online. The most prevalent images, and they did a number of focus groups, and some of the most prevalent images that young Black girls were seeing were the tropes, like the tropes that we often see around the angry Black woman, Black women being called ugly, Black women not being protected. We can think of Megan Thee Stallion. We can think of kind of those contemporary examples, the messaging of dehumanization. While those stories are not necessarily like unheard, I think that the way that they land on the body, like we talk about embodiment when we're scrolling, when we're looking at all of this content, I think has a unique experience on Black folks. We need to take that not just intersectional lens, but nuanced lens within intersectionality.
What are the health impacts of this misogynoir and transmisogynoir online?
I think that we need to be looking at this issue the same way that we look at overall, you know, gender-based violence and looking at the social determinants of health, the impacts on mental health, the impacts on physical safety. While I can't speak to every individual experience, because as someone that exists in a body that, you know, identify as non-binary, my experience is going to be very different than that of a Black trans woman, in which we know that Black trans women are not only targeted in person, but also online as well. Even in death, even in the ways in which femicide happens. You know, when I think about the impact on the body, it's the heightened sense of, and its connection to social determinants of health and the ways in which violence just operates on a day-to-day basis. I think about the lack of safety, the literal lack of safety, the disconnection from community, not knowing how to trust folks, like the anxiety. Like, I can't tell you how many of community members that I've engaged with that have talked about the heightened sense of unsafety and even going outside and even going to community events because they don't know, you know, what's going to happen and they don't know if they're going to be attacked. And whether or not that is a reality or a perceived sense of fear, I think it speaks to the impact of the violence that's experienced online. There isn't that digital divide that, you know, of in person and online anymore. And we know that that's not new. It's critical for not just frontline workers and not just folks that are interested in these issues, but like everyday citizens to recognize the material impacts on the body that contribute to, it's like the way that anti-Black racism operates within the health system, right? Like these have impacts on our bodies. You know, how do you explain to your doctor, like, I'm having anxiety because of online? And what does that look like? And what is the cultural competence around accessing, you know, support, if you can even get a doctor that won't be problematically racist, or a counselor as well? And also linking it to the ways in which systems can respond to support survivors and how that capacity building needs to happen. And because there's not a lot of research, there's a trickle effect in terms of service provision on all fronts. Just as we look at the symptoms of it on survivors and those who are impacted by digital hate, how do we also look at the systemic responses that support that, knowing that there's not a lot of research on it, but that this is a key issue and a key indicator of the way that folks are experiencing gender-based violence online? There is a push within the feminist movement to really reform the way in which tech companies respond to digital hate and online misogynoir, you know, whether it's having policies or practices or not using that like lens of, oh, it's an afterthought in terms of the violence that folks experience online. But we need to be able to connect that to other systemic responses that are anti-carceral. It's not about creating additional punitive measures that are just going to criminalize survivors who do come forward in other ways.
What are some systemic solutions you'd like to see when it comes to ending online misogynoir?
When it comes to philanthropic institutions that are looking to fund this work, whether it's Public Health Canada or whether it's CWF or other philanthropic institutions, there needs to be a key indicator that looks at anti-Black racism and misogynoir when looking at prevention methods and looking at online digital hate. That's point number one. How are we funding the work? And how are we funding the people that are doing this work? Government has a responsibility in that as well, to look at taking a public health approach. I talked a bit about this earlier, but taking a public health approach to gender-based violence and online misogynoir. I think that the overall feminist movement, and it doesn't, you know, I want to be very conscious when I say that, because I know that there's been frontline workers and some of whom are my mentors who have been engaged deeply because, you know, online hate towards Black women is not new. When the internet was created, like the 90s, you know, that's what we're talking about. We saw the impacts of misogynoir while it wasn't named as that at that time, which I also want to specifically name that misogynoir is a term that was coined by Moya Bailey in the early 2000s to look at the ways in which Black women, femmes, and non-binary folks experience unique realities around hatred towards Black women and violence towards Black women and non-binary folks. when we're talking about prevention, the digital divide cannot exist. You know, I know that we've moved into discourses where we don't take a one-size-fits-all model, but we need to move beyond just talking about intersectionality. We really need to get nuanced in our prevention methods, in our community methods, in our community public education methods, around how we talk about these issues. I briefly touched upon this earlier, but also within tech companies, making misogynoir an afterthought, being really strategic of the creation of online safety policies and practices that respond to the unique needs of Black folks online, because as we are in an age of disinformation and strategic, the co-optation of movements, when we even think about that and the ways in which the language around wokeness, the language, like it's Black women, it's Black folks who have come up, the targets are, it's like a clear line rather than like this ambiguous rooted line in the violence towards even the ideologies that are our own that then get co-opted and used against us. Tech companies have a role. The other kind of solution that I wanted to talk about is one that I haven't seen engaged with quite a bit, but it's something that, you know, our members have brought to my attention. The ways in which when folks who are doing this work, the safety mechanisms for them. So I think about Black public educators that are experiencing unique violence online as they are trying to talk about the issues of misogynoir. So what are the mechanisms around like decent work that we need to be thinking about? Continued engagement, and I'm not just talking about like academic research, but continuous engagement around the discourse of these issues is key and should be at the forefront rather than an afterthought. The playbook against trans women online, like that, we can learn a lot from the violence that's experienced, which is like a difficult thing to even say in itself, because it's like we can learn from and we need to interrogate that in itself. And I think it's critical that we center those who are impacted and who often don't occupy positions of power, even within our movements, to learn what are their experiences and how can we bridge those gaps in terms of solutions.
And how about individual users in digital spaces? What safety tips and tools would you recommend for them?
For individual folks that may be listening and thinking like, okay, thank you, Yemi, for all of those systemic underpinnings and solutions that you have shared. And I am one person and I need safety in the here and now. What are some things that you can suggest? Because I'm isolated and I may not know who to talk to. Because logging off is not always the solution. What are the cultures of care that you want to cultivate for yourself, your online experience? It's not necessarily about creating a safety plan, but engaging in ways that are generative for you. You know, I think about the NAP ministry online and the messages that Trisha Hershey has to offer us around rest is resistance. Also, the reminders that she offers us around the ways in which misogynoir and taking care of ourselves. So she has a whole plethora of resources and practices that if you're not familiar with, I encourage you. It's something that I use in myself for myself, because she is often at the crux of that online hate and misogynoir where she gets vitriol. Those experiences lend itself to everyday folks that are online and the things that we witness, you know, having an accountability buddy, you know, to be able to connect with the things that you're seeing online, someone to connect with, to just shoot the gosh damn shit, you know, and be like, can you believe this? We do not exist in vacuums of individualism. As Black folks, we've always existed in spaces of community. And so leaning into that online and offline digital surveillance for survivors, and I'm just kind of pivoting now, being able to engage in ways that will make you feel safe. So whether it's consistently changing your passwords, whether it's, you know, the thing, Andrea, I'm really struggling with is like not victim blaming, right? Like not being like, do these things to keep yourself safe. That's the kind of tension you're hearing me work out in real time.
And I think it can be helpful for some folks to know, like, oh, right, I should be changing my password because I don't know who has access to it. Right. Like, maybe, you know, posting stuff in real time isn't a good option because, you know, I know that someone is potentially surveillancing me and it doesn't feel safe for me to do so. And I have the agency and can do that as part of what I need to do to keep myself safe, you know? Oh, right. I can tell people not to post shit of me online. Those consent-based practices with our people. Those are some things that I think on an individual level can support survivors, is taking the agency of what you do want and what you don't want and how you want to engage with these tools, because that's what they are, tools.
All right, now what? As Yami recommends, do check out Trisha Hershey's resources at trishahershey.com and on social media at the NAB Ministry. Get the facts on gender digital hate, harassment, and abuse by visiting our fact page on CanadianWomen.org. While you're there, read about our new Feminist Creator Prize to uplift feminist digital creators advocating for gender justice, safety, and freedom from harm. Did this episode help you? Did you learn anything new? We want to know. Please visit this episode's show notes to fill out our brief listener survey. You'll be entered to win a special prize pack. This series of podcast episodes has been made possible in part by the Government of Canada. Please listen, subscribe, rate, and review this podcast. If you appreciate this content, please consider becoming a monthly donor to the Canadian Women's Foundation. People like you will make the goal of gender justice a reality. Visit CanadianWomen.org to give...
All right. Directions on how to use your radio. Find the power button. Turn it to on. Turn the knob to CKUT 90.3 FM. Relax and enjoy.
Kristen Carter, my debut contemporary pop album Full Bloom is now yours to discover. Full Bloom is a living garden of 12 songs that celebrates the beauty and the seasonal nature of life. You can find Full Bloom wherever you listen to music. Visit thekristencarter.com or follow at Kristen Carter Music for more. Funded by Factor and Canada's private radio broadcasters.
Entertainment presents a night dedicated to the ladies. Ladies' Night.
Yes, it's ladies' night and the feeling's right.
Saturday, May 11th, 2024, inside the Noel Alexander Banquet Hall, 4065 Jean Talon West. Featuring live from Jamaica, Bill Cosby. Alongside Montreal's own Nighthawk International and DJ Nicholas. Limited 2-for-1 tickets available at $40. Regular tickets at $25 more at the door. Tickets available at Frontline Restaurant and Mango Bay Restaurant. Or call 514-803-1774 or 514-688-3713. Ladies' Night, Saturday, May 11th, 2024. Inside the Noel Alexander Banquet Hall.
Production Nuit d'Afrique invites you to the gala of the 17th edition of Slie d'Or de la Musique du Monde. See you on Tuesday, April 25th at La Tulipe from 8 p.m. onwards. Come out and support your favorite artists to help them win the Slie d'Or d'Argent and des Bronzes. Le Slie d'Or de la Musique du Monde is a celebration that brings the cultures of the world together. For more information, visit CelineDoll.com.
My platform has set me up to receive negativity being a woman on all different standpoints.
Digital hate, harassment, and violence hurt so many women, girls, and two-spirit, trans, and non-binary people. Content creators who address gender justice, like Alicia McCarville, have a lot to teach us about it. I'm Andrea Gunrat from the Canadian Women's Foundation. Welcome to All Right, Now What, a podcast from the Canadian Women's Foundation. We put an intersectional feminist lens on stories that make you wonder, why is this still happening? We explore systemic roots and strategies for change that will move us closer to the goal of gender justice. The work of the Canadian Women's Foundation and our partners takes place on traditional First Nations, Métis, and Inuit territories. We are grateful for the opportunity to meet and work on this land. However, we recognize that land acknowledgements are not enough. We need to pursue truth, reconciliation, decolonization, and allyship in an ongoing effort to make right with all our relations. Whether you're on social media, streaming platforms, dating, messaging, and meeting apps, or on game sites, if you're a woman, girl, or two-spirit, trans, or non-binary person, you're at greater risk of hate, harassment, and violence. There's a lot of research on how social media can negatively impact regular users and expose them to harmful content. But those with a prominent online presence tend to experience more digital harassment themselves. That includes politicians, academics, journalists, and professional content creators and highly followed influencers. These creators and influencers can be subject to repeated insults and derogatory and humiliating comments on a daily basis. Women influencers report more severe consequences to this harassment, such as going into a state of shock and facing economic and financial losses as a result of it. Over coming months, we're delving into gender digital hate and harassment with leading experts and content creators, releasing in-depth episodes every single week. We talk about the problem and what we can do to change it. We offer practical tips to help you in your digital life, and we talk about what it means to take back the tech for all of us. We're joined by creator Alicia McCarville. Alicia uses humor to tackle conversations around body image, worth, and self-love, sharing everything from workout routines and dance videos to updates on her relationship with her husband. Alicia hopes to relate, inspire laughter, and break down barriers. A note about content: this episode addresses gender-based violence and suicide.
I am a self-love comedy content creator from the East Coast of Canada here in Halifax, Nova Scotia. I love to give a shout out to my East Coast roots because I think that does tell people a little bit about my heart. I started creating on TikTok 4 years ago. My anniversary is actually November 27th. It'll be 4 full years. I shared a humorous video about the difference between the level of hotness of me and my husband, and it went viral for multiple reasons, and it just opened up a really cool conversation with a lot of people who don't view themselves as equals to their partners in some form or way in their relationship. It has grown into a space that I get to talk about, you know, my high school sweetheart. It has grown into a space where I get to make people laugh. It has grown into a space where I get to have tough conversations around our body and diet culture and the way the world has made us believe we need to look. I also get to have cool conversations about movement and about the world and about my everyday life. It has become a really safe space for me, but also people who identify with me. The coolest part about what I get to do is just getting to hear people tell me their stories about how they're living a more fulfilled life, because I'm living a more fulfilled life online, and that'll never, ever get old.
You have millions of followers as a person of influence on social media. Like other feminist creators we've interviewed, your experience getting targeted online must be just a constant challenge.
We can start with the top level, and that's women being funny. I get that often, is that women aren't funny, they can't be funny, they don't have a place to be funny. And I disagree with that. I think my whole life has been based in humor. I think that if you're not laughing in a world like today, you're often crying. And I think that it's so important, while I'm having conversations about body diversity and equity and living a fulfilled life, that we take a break every once in a while to laugh a little, because this is hard work that people are doing, learning to love themselves. So from a top level, I've gotten it from the comedy standpoint. Being plus size as a woman, I get it from that angle, having a husband who is physically fit. I'm often faced with, you know, I shouldn't look this way. My husband shouldn't love me if I look this way. I need to look a certain way in order to keep my husband or to deserve love. I get it from a standpoint of me saying I don't want children. As somebody who identifies as a woman, I've chosen not to have children, and I receive a lot of negative energy and comments and in my space from often other women, and some men in the space because of that choice. And I think that has a lot to do with how we've been made to believe that we fit into society, and that's, you know, raising children, bearing children, raising children, and staying at home and doing these things. And I definitely work outside of that norm now. So I think I experienced that also. And then in general, I just think as a woman in an online space, I'm seen as not equal, an easy target when it comes to comments and hate, and the majority of the negativity that comes in my space when it comes to like genuine hate and attacks on my safety or who I am come from men in that online space. And we're talking boys as young as 12 to men in their 70s who have children. And, you know, so I feel like my platform has set me up to receive negativity being a woman on all different standpoints, but we've just been kind of rolling with the punches in that humorous type of take it as we can and do with it what I think is going to empower others, because I'm not the only person in this space that's doing comedy. I'm not the only plus size body in this space. I'm not the only person married to a physically fit husband. You know, I'm not the only person who's chosen not to have children. So I like to shed light on it so that I can empower others to stick up for themselves or stick up for people who are like me.
Many of your followers also respond positively to your affirming and uplifting content. Do any of those reactions really stand out to you?
Every single one of them. Honestly, the majority of, you know, we talk about the negativity because I think that the impact of negativity is often felt a lot deeper than the impact of positivity. You hope that people are going to be positive. You hope that people are going to receive your content in a positive, impactful way. But for me, I think what means the most when it comes to my content and what I put out there is that people are living better lives because of it. And whether that's you've had a tough day and you've come to my space to laugh, or you've been playing with this idea of choosing not to have children, and I've empowered you to have that tough conversation with a loved one, or if you are not the same size as your partner and watching me live my life, not the same size of my partner, makes you feel a little bit more empowered in your body, then that is what I am here to do. But I don't shy away from the negative, and I think that that's really important. And I'm sure you probably heard it in some other conversations, but this space, this online space, has been viewed for years as a safe space for a mask, for people to say what they want, whenever they want, about whoever they want, without repercussions. And from the day I started online, I was told, well, you should expect this. You have an online platform. You should expect this. This just comes along with this. And I agree. I can expect that not everybody is going to like me or agree with what I do, but I do not have to accept any type of negative behavior that makes me feel unsafe or makes people in my space feel unsafe. And that's where I've kind of been trying to challenge this idea that you are anonymous online. Nobody is anonymous online, and nobody deserves anonymity online, especially when you're using that anonymity to make other people feel bad about themselves or inadequate. Or we're talking 2023. There are people who are anonymously online making other people not want to live. And that is just the truth about the negativity in the space online. And I never want to be complacent with that. I never want to accept that for myself, because I know that out there, there are people that look like me. And if I accept it for myself, then they'll view that as a accepting it for themselves, whether that's online or in their personal life. And I think, yeah, it's important, obviously, to talk about the positive. And yes, I receive so much good out of it. However, the negative exists. And I think it's so important to just kind of pull back those curtains every once in a while to be like, yeah, I love what I do. Yeah, people are changing their lives because of me. However, this exists still, and this is still worth a conversation.
In these interviews about gender digital harm, it just floors me again and again how platforms are set up to reward some of the worst comments and abusive behavior. And this is something we have to wrestle with in digital spaces.
Yeah, I would be lying to you if I said that I don't know that negative content performs. I know that when I perform or put out content that is going to get a reaction from people, I know what I'm doing. I know when people see the contrasting sides between me and my husband, that the negative comments that are going to come from that, or the views that are going to come from that, are going to boost my content. And you're right, it's an unfortunate part of our algorithm. I jokingly say this all of the time, but Instagram has come up with a hide feature where the algorithm on Instagram tries to hide negative comments. My Instagram hide feature has never hidden a single negative comment. It has only ever hidden good comments. So it's so funny. Me and my husband joke about it now. I have to go on. It actually makes the negative comments more viewable because it hides so many positive comments. However, I do want to say this. I'm saying this in a joking tone because this is a feature that's not existed before. This is a feature that Instagram has put into place to start protecting creators and people online. So I am forever thankful that they've also put in a feature to turn off comments from people who don't follow you. They've also turned on features to not allow people to slide into your DMs who do not follow your content and are part of your platform. So there are apps on these platforms like Instagram, and I'm going to say that they're at the forefront of that, that are working really hard to try to find ways so that we can really customize our platforms so that we can feel safe. That being said, I know enough to know about my algorithm that if I turn off my comments from everybody, then my videos aren't going to go as viral. They're not going to get pushed as far. And that, again, goes along with what I was saying when people are like, oh, this is what you do. You have to accept it. You have to expect it. Our apps are making us fall within that realm too. We have to expect that I can go back to all of my viral videos, except for maybe a few. And the majority of them are viral because of the way that society perceives me and my husband, or perceives me as a fat woman, or perceives me as a humorous person. And the comments in the comment section are, I'd say 40% not good. And they start out 100% not good. And then eventually it hits the right audience, and eventually it grows and you get those more positive. But as you said, our algorithms are pushing. And to be very fair, as a society, we live for drama. We live for the negative. We're interested in those types of things. We haven't been brought up to really focus on the positive. And that has shown in our news, that's shown in our magazines, that's shown in the stories we consume. Go through Snapchat. In order to watch a YouTube video, most people have to have a clickbaity title to pull you in, something that draws your attention. So as a society, we've been made to believe that the drama and the negative and the violence and those types of things are what has our views. And it really isn't. Unless it's an over-the-top positive thing, we're not really set to consume it. So yeah, I understand that that's how the algorithms work. And I, as a creator, play to that because I know that that's how I'm going to get my views. But you're definitely right. It is an algorithm thing, and there is a way to be shedding light and boosting better, more positive content. There's a button at all of these apps that someone can be pushing when they see these positive contents and be pushing them out to other people. But again, once you dig deep enough, there's dollar values and there's, you know, bills to be paid. And it's one of those unfortunate things. And that's why I like to touch on the society, because I don't choose the virality of my videos. Society does. I don't choose which ones are going to go viral. And if I were to choose which ones were to go viral, of the 20 that have gone viral, maybe only two of those 20 would have chosen to have gone viral.
Can you share how you deal with digital hate, harassment, and abuse on your feeds? Can you share any tips?
I have a 3E system that I follow within my Instagram and TikTok. So I erase, I educate, I eradicate. Those are kind of my three steps that I take personally to separate myself as a content creator from my content. Cause I think that that can be really hard, especially when you're dealing with negative platforms and negative comments, is that as a content creator, we are our business. We are the things that we put out, but I like to take a business approach to my content. So I'll erase the things that I think don't have merit in my space. And I get to decide what those are because this is my space. You're not entitled to opinion on my platform. You're not entitled to say whatever you feel like in my space. You're not. And I get that often. And that's one of the things that I think people are confused about when it comes to opinion and where it's necessary or where it's asked for and where it's valued. If I post a picture or a video of me in a beautiful dress and I feel good, you're not entitled to come into my space to tell me I would look better in that if I were thin. You're not entitled to come into my space to make me feel less valuable than I felt when I posted the video. And I truly believe that. So I'll erase comments that I think devalue me or people who look like me. I choose to erase and not delete people from my platform because I think representation matters. And I think that this is really important when it comes to what we're talking about here. Even if you don't like me, even if you don't like the content that I pursue, every time you see me, your tolerance for me builds, and your tolerance for people who look like me and act like me and talk like me and in relationships like me builds. So that's why I like the erase, because I think that it's valuable for people to see me, even if they don't necessarily enjoy me. I'll educate when I think that the information that's being placed on my platform, said about me or said about others, is incorrect, because I think that erasing it doesn't allow people who look like me or identify like me to truly feel empowered to defend themselves in situations like that. Do I think that every time I educate a negative comment that person who wrote it, it's like, oh, you're right. Shucks. I'll never say this again. No, I don't. But I do feel like people who look like me and people who are reading those comments read those words and feel more empowered to stick up for themselves in other situations. And that is my goal. My job isn't to educate bullies. That's their job. My job in my space is to make people who look like me and feel like me more empowered to continue to be themselves in a world that continuously tells them not to be. And then I eradicate. And I think that this is a valuable one. Nobody is entitled to my space, my time, my work, my effort, just because it is online. You're not entitled to speak to me a certain way just because you're on a keyboard. You're not entitled to try to make me feel less than just because we're in an internet space. I will eradicate you just as quickly as you came into it, because I deserve to feel safe in my space. This last year has been really me taking back that power. Before, I kept thinking, oh, every time I block somebody, that's one less person who could follow me. And that's me suffering from my people pleaser. Like, I need everybody to like me. There are billions of people in this world. Your follow, your comment, I don't need it. There are other people out there who look like me, who want to be around me, who respect me, who will add value to my space. I don't need you in it. Those are kind of how I sit from my business standpoint with the negativity, but I choose to address it sometimes and I choose to address it in others. I used to shy away from posting people's usernames on my videos or shedding light on their things because people would be like, oh no, like now people are going to bully them or now. And I'm like, no, this isn't an anonymous space. You don't get to hide behind a username to say what you want. And then when you suffer the repercussions of being identified as somebody who is bullying me or others in the space, you don't get to do that. Sometimes I have time. Sometimes I've gone as far as messaging people's family to say, this is what your son is doing on the internet. Because if they're saying it to me, I'm not the only person they're saying that to. I'm not the only person that they're abusing in their life. I've had instances where I've had employees that are in positions of power over women, over fat people, who are in my space saying hurtful and unkind things about me and about fat people in general. And then you go to their work profile and they're an inclusive yoga instructor. Like hell you are, because inclusivity doesn't count just in your classroom. Inclusivity counts in your life. And when you're saying hurtful and unkind things on the internet space about people who look like me, there's no possible way you're creating an inclusive space in your classroom, even if you think you are. So I think that we're coming to an era where people are starting to kind of put their foot down, starting to kind of create safer spaces. But my 3E system for me is how I try to separate myself from my business. But sometimes I have time. Sometimes I have time to sit and to ask questions and to shed light on what people are actually doing online, because I think that that is also a valuable lesson for a lot of people too as well. So
you're making me think about the notion of cancel culture, so connected to digital life, and how Roxane Gay reframes it, that it's not really about canceling, it's about consequences and accountability, and that's not a bad thing.
Cancel culture is a very nuanced topic, especially when it comes to dealing with human beings and platforms and living in a social media era. I'm not a perfect human being. I don't think anybody is perfect. I think that this idea that anybody in this world, no matter what their platform and what they do, is a perfect person is so incorrect. And I think that the more we choose to live in our imperfection, the easier things will be for all of us. To say I'm sorry, to say I didn't know that, to accept responsibility for the things that we're doing. But when it comes to online space, the only way to seek justice for those who choose to use the internet as a mask is to unmask them. And I'm a firm believer of that, especially when it comes to abuse and hate online, is to not allow people to sit in that and continue in that. Because I'm a tough cookie. I've been bullied my whole entire life. I'm not shy to tough conversations. I've been told to end my life multiple times. I've been told that I'm not of value very many times. I can manage that. I am in a point in my life where I can read those things and they roll off my back, or I just need to take a quick break. But there are people that are living in this world that those things don't roll off their back. They become a weight that they have to carry every single day, and every comment and every one of those things just becomes a weight until so long down the road that weight is just too heavy and they can't carry it anymore. So yes, I will accept that. I will accept those weights because I know there are people that can't carry them, but me accepting it doesn't change it from them being able to pass that on to someone else down the road. Me giving them consequences for their actions is what holds them accountable to the things that they're saying, and hopefully they won't say it down the road. That's why I like the educate portion, and that's why I like the eradicate and erase portion in my ease, because sometimes you do educate people and sometimes they do say, I'm sorry. And that does happen. It has happened to me, and it happens to me pretty regularly now. It's a very nuanced topic, obviously, talking about cancel culture, etc. But I think in this space, the only way to really stop people from doing the things that they're doing is to unmask them online. And they're going to say the wrong thing to the wrong person, and someone's going to get hurt. And if I allow people to exist like that online, I'm contributing to that. I'm saying that it's okay. And I'm not okay with being someone that condones that type of behavior in my space or online. I don't want people to have to say what I say. Like, that's the goal. That's the goal for me. I don't want people to experience the life that I've experienced with, like, online, with my body, with my grief for not, you know, doing things with my, the whole goal of me having that platform is so that people realize their value sooner than I did, so that they can live more happier, fulfilled lives sooner than I did. And that doesn't just start with, you know, me sharing the happy-go-lucky, beautiful things that happen in my life. That starts with having tough conversations, because I needed to have had them a long time ago. And I think that the beauty of my platform, and what I'm most proud of when it comes to my platform, is you're going to get me on good days, and you're going to get me on bad days, and you're going to get me on every day in between. And I think that that is the human experience, that is the human experience of what we're all going through. There's all different things that impact us. And yeah, I could come out with just all positive content. Yeah, I could come out with all of these life is glorious and wonderful, but that's not the reality. And the reality is that there are tough days and there are tough spaces and mean things are still being said. And it doesn't really matter how positive I am, that negativity and that harassment and that abuse is still going to exist. So my job is to show you it and then teach you how to have the tools moving forward to protect yourself, protect people you love, and how to empower you to feel comfortable doing so.
What do you think needs to change to end gender digital hate, harassment, and abuse?
Content creation in general, I think you hit the nail on the head when you talk about the algorithm. Our apps have the power in what goes viral. Our apps have the power in how those algorithms work. They choose them. Just like our magazines had the power when we were kids to choose what they put on the front of them, and they still chose to not show us real bodies. I understand that there's money out there. However, the one thing that I have learned and I love so much about my platform is that my platform has taught me is that I made myself a minority in a world where I'm the majority. I made my fat body and the things that I have wrong with it, or me, the way I felt about it, as if I was an outlier to all of these thin, beautiful, picturesque people, when realistically, those thin, beautiful, picturesque people are the minority in our world. The majority of people do not look like them. And it is the one instance in society where we are really trying really hard to be the minority of a group of people. And when realistically we have the power, and somehow we've allowed all of these things to kind of take it away from us or make us believe that we don't have the power. I don't know what that means. And I think it is going to take an app and apps to kind of make that shift. And unfortunately, that does mean losing numbers and seeing a change. But I think that there are more people out there not using these apps because of the damage that they do than there are people using them. And I truly do believe that. I think that if things were to change and more positivity were to be seen, and more people with authentic, true, real life platforms were to be viewed, that more people would choose to come. So I think it's that. Yes, when I posted my first video, there were a lot of negative people, but from that, there were so many more positive people because they saw themselves in me. And I think that there's tons of creators that are doing a good job that deserve to have bigger platforms than they do. And that's just genuinely the truth. I think that platforms like TikTok do a really good job of trying to showcase every group of people and trying to make it, whether we're talking like Black History Month or Pride Month, or they do a good job. But I think we just need to just do it all of the time. I don't think that it, you know, I think that we just need to do a better job of showcasing all people all of the time for everything. Those months are valuable always. However, often most businesses and most platforms get stuck in this, okay, well, we were celebrating it this month, or how about we just start using our algorithm to push everybody all of the time too, and we can get a little bit more out of it. When it comes to protecting yourselves as a creator, because at the end of the day, we can sit and wait for the apps to do those things, but you don't know how long you're going to be waiting. And that doesn't mean you don't deserve to have a platform or a space or create. And I think that that's super important. So for protection, I think it's really important for you to know your privacy, protection, and safety settings on all of your apps. First and foremost, as a content creator, there is a, on both TikTok and Instagram, and I believe also Facebook, there's a section where you can go and write in words that cannot be posted on your platforms. This was the most powerful thing I ever did. So if a specific gendered word or slur or your address or whatever it might be, you can type it right into this box, and then nobody will ever be able to type it on your platform. And anytime it does pop up, it automatically gets pulled and blocked off of there. And that was the first thing that I really did for my safety. And that took me 2 years to do. And with that, it filtered out so many people, which I think is really important. Two, you need to know what you're capable of handling. Alicia from 10 years ago couldn't do this. Alicia 10 years ago wouldn't have had the confidence to be able to say the things that I say and accept the abuse that I do. And going along with that, you need to expect it. You do not have to accept it, but you need to be confident enough to not accept it. There's nothing wrong with not being able to do that yet, but you need to know where your boundaries lie. And that is so important to your mental health. That is, this is for content creators and people in the online space. If this is your job, it's like any other job. You wouldn't accept it in a workplace. Do not accept it in an online space. And that's just genuinely the truth. The difference between online as a content creator and real life is that we don't have an HR. You are your HR. You are the person who's responsible for protecting yourself and the others in it. So it is a big responsibility, and you do need to be prepared for it. And then last but not least, this is your space online and nobody's entitled to it. Nobody. Not the most rich people in the world to the nobody is entitled to it. And when you believe that nobody is entitled to it, it makes you feel a little bit more empowered to keep your space safe for yourself and for others. Because it's online, it's like, oh, well, anybody can say what they want. Well, no, they can't. They don't, they're not entitled to it. And I think the more you own that, the easier it is to use that block button a lot sooner than I did, the easier it is for you to create a safer space for yourself. To kind of recap that is to expect it, but not accept it, to be very aware of your boundaries and to understand that nobody is entitled to your space, your time, your work, your effort. Nobody's entitled to that. And when you feel empowered to kind of take that stance on your platform, it'll be a lot safer space for you and for others who see yourself, themselves in you. It's kind of how I get through day to day. And then I throw in a few jokes in there because life's hard and you gotta laugh a little.
All right, now what? Check out Alicia McCarville on Instagram and TikTok at Alicia McCarville. Get the facts on gender digital hate, harassment, and abuse by visiting our fact page on CanadianWomen.org. While you're there, read about our new Feminist Creator Prize to uplift feminist digital creators advocating for gender justice, safety, and freedom from harm. Did this episode help you? Did you learn anything new? We want to know. Please visit this episode's show notes to fill out our brief listener survey. You'll be entered to win a special prize pack. This series of podcast episodes has been made possible in part by the Government of Canada. Please listen, subscribe, rate, and review this podcast. If you appreciate this content, please consider becoming a monthly donor to the Canadian Women's Foundation. People like you will make the goal of gender justice a reality. Visit.
If your head is as big as Shamello's, if your bank is the check cash in place, if you put on pantyhose instead of shaving your legs.
Let's see here, we got 60, 75. Oh, brutal. Looks like the socks are getting grilled again. At least I've got some gnarly free radio.
Being ghetto, it's just the things we do sometimes, like hanging your clothes on the oven to dry.
No matter how your laundry gets done, CKUT will still be there for you. 90.3 FM in Montreal.
Can you be rich and be ghetto? Yep. And just because you poor, do that mean that you ghetto? Nope. Some people don't understand what it means to be ghetto. And if you gotta ask, then you probably never know.
Help us spread the word. CKUT is looking for someone to join our team as the chair of the board of directors. Our board of directors reads the fine print, approves the annual budget, engages in community outreach, and keeps CKUT's eye on the bigger picture. The board meets for 2 hours every month, and the chair circulates agendas, keeps meetings organized, and acts as a liaison between the outside world and the board. If you're passionate about the station, this is an opportunity to help lead CKUT into a new era of community media. For more information, please send a message to admin@ckut.ca.
Quebec-raised singer Andrea Superstein is one of the most versatile voices in music today. The new album, Oh Mother, is an ambitious tour de force, highlighting her ever-growing creativity and sensitivity as a songwriter and arranger. Oh Mother is available now. Andrea will be performing at Upstairs Jazz Club in Montreal on Friday, May 3rd. For more information about the show, visit upstairsjazz.com.
Of Montreal and Indie Roots Records have come together to bring you Womban, an all-female artist showcase to bring ovarian cancer awareness to the community and to raise money for Ovarian Cancer Canada. On Friday, May 17th, 8 p.m. at the Jamaica Association of Montreal at 4065 Jean Talon West, Metro Namur. It's a free event, just donate. All funds going to Ovarian Cancer of Canada. For more info, 514-792-4775. This ad is sponsored by CKUT 90.3.
Okay. Hi, this is the What Cheer Brigade, and keep it locked on
CKUT 90.3 Montreal.
It is Wednesday, April 10th.
Directions on how to use your radio. Find the power button. Turn it to on. Turn the knob to CKUT 90.3 FM. Relax and enjoy.
Sound.
CKUT 90.3 FM.
Another reliable communication channel.
You're tuned to Butcher T's Noontime Cuts, hitting every Friday from noon to 2, playing you a wide variety of music just to make your afternoon.